This is Embodied on the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Robeson County has a long history of revolution and resistance, and it's one of the most diverse rural counties in America. Native and Black communities successfully resisted post-Civil War white supremacists. They formed a college to preserve Tuscarora and Lumbee culture in the years following, and then in the 1950s fought off the KKK. And this fight for indigenous rights and liberation continues today. Over the decades, much of this history has been captured in religious and folk music that blend historical events into living memorials and testimony. Musician Charlie Lowry carries that tradition forward. Her songs take on racism, gun violence, and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. She's an independent artist and the lead singer of Dark Water Rising, which claimed Debut Group of the Year from the Native American Music Awards in 2010. Charlie Lowry, welcome back to The State of Things.
Thank you.
So for those of our listeners who are not as familiar with Robeson County, describe the place that you come from for us.
Well, as far as land mass goes, Robeson County is the largest county in the state, and it's in the southeastern part of the state, right on the border of North and South Carolina, and it's full of flat lands, a lot of farmlands. Agriculture has always been big for our people, dating back centuries ago. A lot of swamps. Where I grew up or where I live now, my backyard is the swamp. So I have a close connection to the land and to the water.
And you say that music is very much in the water. Tell me about that.
There's probably someone in every family that can carry a tune or play an instrument. They may not do it publicly, but it's in the water. It's got to be in the water. A lot of our folks get their musical bugs out in church, and they've grown up playing in church, and it's passed down from one generation to the next, with a lot of younger generations learning from their grandmothers and grandfathers, or, you know. So it's passed down in the families.
And how did you get started? When did you first notice your passion for music?
Ooh. First noticed my passion for music. I don't know. It's just something that I've always done. And I think maybe when I was around 12, I actually proclaimed that I wanted to be a singer when I grew up. And I can remember that from a job shadowing interview in middle school, when they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I think that was one of the first times that I declared that I wanted to be a singer, along with a WNBA player and a veterinarian.
All of those big dreams.
Yeah. But music has been the one that I've actually pursued. Ever since I was a toddler, as soon as I could talk, I was singing and making up songs or carrying melodies around in my head. And my first vivid moment of performing in front of people outside of my family, my immediate family, was singing in church. I used to travel up to Detroit, Michigan, or Warren, Michigan, with my grandfather. We had relatives that live in Michigan, and I used to stand in front of the congregation as early as maybe 4 years old, singing the B-I-B-L-E.
And your grandfather was a big inspiration for you, as were the rest of your extended family. You've always been so close and so connected to your family.
Yes, I have a large family on both sides, my mother and father's sides. But my grandfather was the first person I can remember having an instrument in the home. He had an electric guitar, and he used to get together with his friends on Sunday afternoons after church and play gospel hymns. And he never played lead guitar. He just played really basic open chords. And he was the first one that instilled the love of music in me. And I grew up, like I said, grew up in church. And I can remember, you know, singing with the congregation, singing hymns, and hearing the different voices and the different leads and the different harmonies. And I can remember me singing too loud and my cousin nudging me on the arm to shh, not, don't sing so loud. But that was that passion and love of Christ. So
And how much of a part of your identity growing up was being Lumbee and having family that was from this place, this piece of land, the historical significance of that? Was that a big part of kind of how you learned about who you were growing up?
Well, pretty much everyone that I grew up with was Lumbee or is Lumbee. My immediate family, my mother, she was the oldest of seven children. She had six brothers, and she was the oldest. But all of them and all of my cousins, we all stay and still to this day pretty much stay within 10 to 15 minutes of each other. And I grew up in, you know, elementary school was predominantly Native American, middle school, high school. It wasn't until I actually went away to college at UNC Chapel Hill that I was exposed to more cultures and races than white, black, and Indian, which is predominantly what Robeson County was growing up. And my Lumbee identity played a huge role in who I am today. When I was 12 years old, I won Junior Miss Lumbee, 1997-98. And that was the first chance that I really had to represent for my people and to dig deeper into our culture and who we were in comparison to the outside world.
So as you moved away and you transitioned to UNC, you mentioned this being a culture shock for you the first time you were around a lot of people who didn't know a lot about who you were or where you came from. Can you take me into what that was like for you? Are there any distinct memories from that time?
Well, I can say that I went with an innocence and I was a bit naive to the ways of the world and other cultures and their views of Native American people. When you come from somewhere where it's predominantly Native, you don't question some things, or you don't even think to question things. You just walk in indigenous footsteps. But then when you get somewhere like UNC Chapel Hill that's so diverse, and as soon as I open my mouth, they look at me and they look at my skin tone and they can't figure out, I'm not white, I'm not black, what are you? Was the question that I got. And in my head, I'm thinking, I'm a human being. What do you mean, what am I? But then I knew it was my responsibility to dig even further into my culture and my people and where we come from, who our ancestors really are, just our place in the world, to be able to share that. Even though, you know, I grew up only an hour and a half away from Chapel Hill, there were a lot of people there that didn't think that Natives still existed, that we had been killed off. They didn't understand that there was a thriving culture right in their backyard almost.
And that really became a source of your music, this feeling of being an outsider and your want and desire to translate your own experience to other people. And you have a song that reflects on this. And I'm wondering whether you could kind of explain that song to us, and then we'll have you sing us out of the segment with that song.
Sure. The name of the song is Brown Skin. And it was, if I'm not mistaken, it's the first full original song that I co-wrote. I wrote it along with my best friend. Her name's Brittany Jacobs Locklear. She's Coharie from Clinton, North Carolina, a smaller tribe. But she experienced the same things going to UNC Chapel Hill. And so we wrote this song in particular for women, because as minority women, I guess we're expected to look a certain way, copper skin, long black hair. And that kind of threw people off when we say we're indigenous, but I don't fit the stereotypical profile that they're used to seeing on television. And so Brittany and I got together in our dorm room and wrote this song and addressed several more issues.
All right, I'm going to have you play it for us. But if our listeners want to check out the song in its entirety or the rest of your music, they can head to our website, stateofthings.org. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our conversation with Charlie Lowry will continue after this. Please stay with us.
an existence so beautiful, so colorful, deep rooted in originality. Eye candy of shallow minds, that was her reality still. She walks around with a smile for the whole wide world to see. Inside to scream and free herself from strains of society. Brown skin, why do you hide the pain within? Brown skin, brown skin. Day in, day out is the same, living by the standards of a male domain. She can't help but recognize the stares, 'cause of who she's talking to, the clothes she wears, yet she holds her head up high for the whole wide world to see. Inside to scream and free herself from strains of society. Brown skin, why do you hide the pain within? Brown skin, brown skin. I get tired of people telling me I ain't gonna make it, so I use it as fuel to feed my hunger like food. Like a cake that I'm baking takes time and patience. Once it starts to rise, everybody wants a taste. Why you always up on the line trying to play my face? Like I ain't gonna make it. People like you that hold us back from getting stacked, so we go through the same routine every day, trying to conjure like voodoo. Who knew I'd do the extraordinary one? Little lumpy brown skin, little mama with the country grammar, green sky independent. Tell me you're feeling this. Fire water over smoking the evil, like a joker going wild trying to clown my people. Poverty stricken, keep your head up. Yeah, we fed up, people let up, automatically assume it's a setup. Living from paycheck to check, minimum wage from the state. Don't spend it all in one place, and if your belly aches, take a step back, baby. Hone your skills, or what's happening? So go ahead and throw your hands up like a criminal. The going gets tough, you feel the need to surrender. If I was sold on every single diss, I'd marinate on hell and drive not doing. Brown skin, why do you hide the pain within? Brown skin, how long will you continue to pretend that who you know where you go won't face the life you live? That what you do where you be will catch up with you in the end. Oh yeah, live your own life, don't worry about the need to please. Be the queen of your own society. Yeah, oh yeah. Brown skin, brown skin, brown.
This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. North Carolina has the most American Idol winners of any state in the country. And in 2004, back in the show's heyday, a young Lumbee woman out of Robeson County made it to Hollywood. Jane of Blues.
Thank you.
But Charlie, you know I love your speaking voice. It reminds me of my Southern heritage. Say something to these fine people.
Hello, America. Is that good?
Oh, I love that.
Thank you.
So she didn't win the competition, but Charlie Lowry went on to win North Carolina's heart as an independent artist and the lead singer of Dark Water Rising. And she's my guest today. So, Charlie, we heard you singing Brown Skin at the end of the last segment. Now we hear your young self singing Chain of Fools. Talk about how you feel about how you kind of represented your identity and artistry at that time, because at the same time you were at UNC and really digging into questions of Lumbee identity, you were on this national stage being asked to kind of showcase your accent, and there's an interesting juxtaposition there.
I miss that girl sometimes. And when you play the clip, I immediately think of my mother and father's faces on the clip. They were just beaming with pride. And I hadn't really gotten into composing my own music yet. I was 20 years old at the time, a sophomore at UNC Chapel Hill. And I can remember having the fire to want to audition and to want to continue to represent for my Lumbee people. But like I said, I hadn't really developed that drive to incorporate my culture and who I was into songwriting yet.
So that came a little later.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned I could see the way that your face was smiling, remembering your mom and dad and them in that audience. I know your mom has especially been such a cheerleader for you, and you recently lost her a couple of years ago. So tell me about your mom and your relationship with her and how that's influenced your music.
So she's my best friend. Her name was Dolores, Dolores Lowry, and she was the one, the constant over the years, the one that pushed me to be a little entertainer. So as soon as she noticed how well I interacted with my grandfather at an early age, in terms of storytelling and singing songs, she was on it. She was like, I'm putting her in dance. I'm going to dress her up as often as I can and put her out in front of people. And so I started taking dance lessons as early as 2. And she was the one that drove me to all of the practices, even in my sports career, in elementary, middle, and high school. She was the one that was driving me to practices, picking me up in the stands at all of the games. As far as singing, when I couldn't play an instrument, she was the one that was scouring the Sound Choice soundtracks catalog to buy my next cassette instrumental. The one always encouraging me to put on lipstick whenever I was performing in front of a crowd. I was her baby, and there was no one better than me. And she always gave me that boost of self-confidence, but she did it with such grace. You know, she taught me to be humble and modest. She could brag on me, but if I, you know, I don't ever remember myself getting out of character and bragging on myself, you know, she wouldn't have allowed that. And she always made sure I had a good home-cooked meal. She always took me to go shopping for wardrobes, which is a big part of artistry, in my opinion, is looking the part. And she always made sure, or she done her best to make sure that I looked the part, all while holding down a full-time job.
Well, you even, I mean, you had a recent experience when you were performing at the Governor's Mansion. So, your career has evolved in so many wonderful ways that we'll keep talking about. But you were recently invited to play a house concert at the Governor's Mansion, a space where you really wished your mom was able to be there. But she made a guest appearance in a kind of an interesting way. I want you to tell us that story.
Yes, she did. And just for the listeners, my mother did pass away in 2017. I lost her to cancer. And for the Governor's Mansion, we had an opportunity to perform as part of the governor's initiative for Come Here, North Carolina, or the governor's wife, Miss Cooper, First Lady Cooper. We were invited to come and showcase Robeson County and storytelling through music. And as I mentioned before, my mother was adamant about me painting my lips, making sure I had some color on my face whenever I performed. And so one of my bandmates, Alexis Rayana Jones, is a makeup artist, and she agreed to do my makeup for this performance. So we get to the Governor's Mansion, and it was already bittersweet. I was already emotional because, in my opinion, this was a top performance, a top tier performance, as far as the history of my career goes. And I was emotional because my mother couldn't be there physically. So we get there, and Alexis is doing my makeup, and she says, "Oh, God, I didn't bring any lipstick." I'm like, "Oh, gosh, I didn't bring any either because I thought you were going to have it." And she's like, "Nope." And she said, "Let me go see if Miss Sherry has some." So Miss Sherry was, or is, Miss Sherry Carter, is the grandmother of one of my bandmates, Sean McNeil. And so Alexis went to see if Miss Sherry had some lipstick. And in my head, I'm thinking, if Mama was here, she would kill me for not wearing lipstick. And so Alexis runs to Miss Sherry and comes back with a brand new tube of lipstick. And I'm like, whew, Miss Sherry saved the day. So I put on the lipstick. And a few minutes before the performance, I go around to the area where folks are seated for the show. And I run to Miss Sherry and I say, "Miss Sherry, thank you so much for that lipstick. I said, Mama would have killed me if she would have known." I said, "And she always had her lips painted. She always wanted to make sure I had my lips painted." I said, "And her favorite shade was Butter Rum by Avon." And Miss Sherry's eyes got huge. And she looked at me and she said, "Charlie," she said, "that's what that shade was, Butter Rum."
Oh, my gosh.
And I still get goosebumps.
So there she was, making sure that your lips were painted with just the right color for your performance at the Governor's Mansion.
I said, out of all the shades in the world that there are, she had the exact shade of that I've known my mother. I mean, even as a child in elementary school picture day, that's what Mama painted my lips with. So, yeah, she was there. I know she was there.
So as your music has evolved over the past decades, since that time at American Idol, since creating and performing Brown Skin, to up to last year when you were at the Governor's Mansion, how would you describe how your style and your approach to your artistry has evolved in that time?
Well, I've always been a believer that as an artist, we are vessels. I feel like I'm a vessel to channel messages and to share those messages with the world. And I'm a compassionate person. So anytime I see somebody hurting, whether it's, you know, internally for their own reasons or whether someone has hurt them, I want to try to help them. And I feel like my music has evolved in a way that I write songs that help people, and they're songs for healing. Hmm. Such as a song that I wrote called Hometown Hero. There was a young girl that passed away, and she passed away in a car accident, and I got to thinking, you know, her family didn't have a chance to tell her goodbye. She was just stripped away from them. And that's what led me to write Hometown Hero, and the words say, you know, I'll be waiting for the chance to see you again. I didn't get a chance to say goodbye here on earth, but the next time I see you in the spirit world, we're going to reunite just like the first time that we met here in the physical world. And I'm very close to Mother Earth. I mentioned that I grew up in the swamps, grew up loving the land. I spent so much time outside, just being an innocent child, playing out in the wilderness. And I'm very fond of Mother Earth. So anytime I see anything that's destructive to Mother Earth, it really hurts me to my core. And I can't understand why people destruct in the way that they do. And I'm only one person. I can't reach everyone. Sometimes people are hard-headed and they don't want to hear, you know, when you want to tell them something. But music is a universal language. So I put my messages into songs to, you know, make people aware of what's going on with Mother Earth and the destruction. It's kind of evolved in that way to relay messages that, hit home for me.
Yeah. So there is an intersection and an overlap between your music and your activism, it seems. And I know you and your mom paddled down the Lumber River protesting the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. You've been involved in a lot of other kind of environmental justice efforts. So talk about that and kind of how you see your identity as an activist and how that blends with your music.
Well, you mentioned paddling the Lumber River. That was a significant day for me, because we were standing up and away from Mother Earth, and because my mother was with me. And she's really the one that helped to instill the love of Mother Earth in me. Hmm. She loved flowers. She loved just the open sky, all animals, and just being on the water with her in our home territory, our river, a river that has protected and nourished our people for centuries, and thinking about the threat of a pipeline that threatens our water, our air, just our general well-being. And the Lumber River has a reputation for being treacherous and hard to navigate, but I love it for it, because it's kind of like there's a direct correlation with our people and our resistance and survival. And so just being with her on the water and standing up, you know, to protect our livelihoods.
And you've chosen to move back to Robeson County. You live there now. You live really close to your family home. How many people of your age moved away and came back? And what's life like for a younger person in Robeson County right now?
That makes me think of American Idol, actually. During my first audition, one of the first things that Simon Cowell ever said to me was that I was old-fashioned.
Hmm.
And I think that has a lot to do with my upbringing. And when you speak about folks my age that have gone away to maybe get educated and have moved back, I wouldn't say it's necessarily old-fashioned, but I say rooted.
Hmm.
We're very rooted in our families and bringing our children up, knowing who they are, as far as being Lumbee and that close kinship that can be found in communities. A lot of our folks are going away to be educated at these institutions, and we're bringing back what we're learning to hopefully better our communities.
You've done a number of collaborations with other Lumbee artists, and you spoke about Alexis earlier on and her accompanying you at the Governor's Mansion. And the two of you recently worked on a song together that pays tribute to missing and murdered Indigenous and Native women. And I want to play a clip from that song now and then have you talk a bit more about it. So let's take a listen. The song is called Keep My Memory.
Things never change. It's pumping through my veins. Nobody ever asked. Now you're running from the past. It's true. Cause I've had enough of your dirty little ego. Educated boy, you should know. After all the blowing pain, you come to judge for me. Give me all the liberty that's due.
That was Keep My Memory by Alexis Rayana. You're listening to the Embodied series on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, speaking with Lumbee Tuscarora musician Charlie Lowry, who's featured on that track. You can see Charlie perform this Saturday at 3 at the Poorhouse Music Hall in Raleigh, as well as Saturday, March 21st in the afternoon at LaBauer Park in Greensboro. And we want to hear your thoughts about this episode and the rest of our series about sex, relationships, and health. You can tweet at us with the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC or post on Instagram, and we will get back to you. So tell me about that collaboration and what you're hoping to get through with that song.
So Alexis and I have known each other for many years, just growing up in the same community. And I want to backtrack a little bit when you mention young folks going away and coming back to Robeson County. Alexis Rayana is also an example of that. She went away to school at UNCW or UNC Wilmington. And as a student there, she ran into some opposition with folks around Halloween time that like to dress up in Indian costumes or Pocahontas costumes. So she really stood up against the students in that manner and ran a campaign of "My culture is not your costume," for folks to understand that this is not something that we play dress up as. This is who we are. So we would prefer you not imitate us in this way. And she brought that knowledge back to Robeson County, and we got together and wrote this song along with the producer that she graduated with. His name is Wiley Withers, and Wiley is based in Nashville, Tennessee. And Alexis is home now in Pembroke, North Carolina. But we went out to Nashville and wrote this song, and we changed the original trajectory of the song to focus on missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so the song, or the title, is "Keep My Memory," and it's basically saying, okay, we've got so many cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women that have happened, that have grown cold. It's like if you can't get the funding or whatever it is that you need to actively pursue these cases, the least that we can do is keep their memories alive, that we can never forget these girls. They're not just random cases. They are, because we come from tight-knit communities as Indigenous people, more than likely these are our sisters, our daughters, grandmothers, our cousins. These are girls that we know. They're not just random. So it's our duties to keep their memories alive and say their names. We can't actually feel the pain that they went through when they lost their lives, but, you know, we carry a part of them with us.
We're going to continue our conversation in a minute. I'm talking with Charlie Lowry. You can find links to everything we've talked about here, some more of our music, at our website, stateofthings.org, as well as photos on our Instagram. Charlie will stay with us as we continue our conversation on the state of things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Lumbee singer-songwriter Charlie Lowry is my guest today. Charlie was born and raised in Robeson County, North Carolina, and her strong community and family ties there shaped the music she still makes to this day. So we've been talking a lot about your music and your relationship with where you come from, but I also would like to talk a bit about your relationship with your body and sickness that you've been experiencing since kind of the beginning of your musical career in a lot of ways. So tell us a bit about Berger's disease, an autoimmune condition that you have, and how it's impacted your life and the evolution of your career.
Well, to be honest, it really has started having an impact on me. Even though I had a kidney transplant in 2009, as far as being present with mind, body, and spirit, it's really started impacting me the past 3 or 4 years. And I say that because all these other years I've just kind of been going with the flow, letting my music Carry Me Away, and it could have something to do with being young and a little naive, but I was first diagnosed when I was 18.
Hmm.
And the doctors told me then that, you know, if I took the medicines that they gave me, which they were experimenting with at the time, there was a chance that I wouldn't have to have a kidney transplant until I was 35. But it came a lot sooner. My first transplant came when I was 25, like I mentioned, in 2009. And so it all just kind of came, and I made it through it while still pursuing my music.
Hmm.
And so music has really been a form of therapy for me. But it's been really heavy on my mind, I think, with watching my mother get sick and then pass away. And now I'm currently on dialysis in need of another kidney transplant.
So what does dialysis look like? What is it kind of a week like for you as you await a transplant?
Well, it's all together, it probably takes around 13 or 14 hours of my week. I go Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays to the Fresenius Clinic in Pembroke, which I'm fortunate that I don't have to drive too far. It's only like a 7-minute drive, and I'm there from 1:10 p.m. until 5:15 now.
Hmm.
Before, I was on first shift, and I was having to get there at 6:40 a.m. and leaving at 11:15 a.m. So the treatments now are 3 hours and 45 minutes.
What do you do during the 3 hours and 45 minutes?
Well, when you walk into the clinic, first thing they have to do is check your lungs, make sure you don't have any fluid in your lungs and in your heart, and make sure you don't have a fever. They check your temperature. They check your weight to see how much fluid you've gained. When you're a person with end-stage renal disease and your kidneys aren't functioning, all of the fluids that you intake, your body holds on to. A lot of people can't make urine, and so everything, all of the fluids in your food, your body holds on to until you can get to the machine and get the fluids pulled off. And so they get my measurements and weight, and then I sit down in a big comfy chair, recline back, and they hook me up to the machine. I actually have a permacatheter that they hook me up to. And you, like I said, it's painless. You can't really tell anything's going on until the end when you get off the machine. And when you get off the machine, that's when you feel like you've done a two or three hour workout in the gym.
Wow. You just feel wiped out.
Just washed out. Just where I just, most of the time I want to go home and get in the bed. But usually I'll sit in the chair, and thank goodness for my good old smartphone, I'll find all kind of crazy stuff to look up and read and catch up on daily gossip and news. And sometimes I'll work on my songwriting. I have some songwriting and theory books that I'll, you know, do some studying with that. Sometimes I'll make beaded earrings, Native American beaded earrings, and usually one pair usually takes anywhere from 3 to 4 hours.
So there's a shift.
So I'll sit there and work on a pair of earrings. I'll sleep sometimes, and, you know, I try to make myself as comfortable as possible. So I'm sitting on a throw blanket. I've got a throw blanket over me, a neck pillow, and it can get chilly in there because you're dealing with blood, you know, so they keep it cold.
Well, as someone who exudes so much energy and creativity and has been involved in so many projects and seems to have such a free spirit, I can imagine that this is really challenging for you. How have you kind of been grappling with it or trying to reframe it for yourself?
It's very challenging.
Yeah.
Every day I wake up, I thank God for waking me up, because the machine is really the only thing here on earth that's keeping me alive. You know, if I didn't go to dialysis, I'd probably be gone within a week,
wow,
a week or 2 weeks. And so while I'm waiting for my kidney transplant, I've come to understand that this is my season of patience and perseverance. And so that's what keeps me going.
And so you're on a waiting list, and what is that process like? You just have to wait until there's someone who's the right match?
Yeah, I've been active on the list for about, I think they go on how long you've been on dialysis. So 3 years. Active on the list at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm active on the list at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. And recently I went up to Johns Hopkins to be evaluated to get on their list. And so it's really a process. I'm not sure what their process is with finding a deceased donor, but for a living donor, if there's someone that wants to donate that's alive, they would reach out to one of the programs and express their interest. And then once they express their interest, then the hospital will then send them information about the whole process. And once they agree to that, then they'll begin their testing.
Okay.
And the first test is checking to see if our blood is compatible. And then if that is approved, they'll move on to the next phase, which involves getting their heart checked out and seeing a social worker and a psychologist. And so there's a lot. I've had to go 3 months to be told that a person wasn't going to be a donor.
Hmm.
So a lot of time goes by when folks are testing. So I've had, I guess, maybe 4 people now that have tested and haven't been, you know, a match yet.
If any of our listeners are interested, we have information about Charlie's search for a new kidney at our website, stateofthings.org. And you can also share any thoughts about the rest of our Embodied series there using the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. So, I mean, you've been doing all of this, meanwhile also creating new musical endeavors, traveling around the country, and you recently collaborated with Rhiannon Giddens. I would love to hear more about that collaboration.
Yes. Well, like I said, music is my therapy, you know. It keeps me going. At the same time, it drives me crazy because I want to write that hit song.
Yes.
But I'm fortunate that with Fresenius, they have clinics all over the country. So wherever I go, if I know ahead of time, I can make arrangements to have my treatments wherever. And Rhiannon reached out to me a couple of months ago, last year actually, probably in the summer of last year, about working on a project together. And she and I met years ago through our mutual friend, Puta Faye, and we actually recorded a song together years ago. And I was hoping that I would get to work with Rhiannon again, and the stars aligned, and we found some time to get together last year. And she had the idea to forge hip-hop with folk and indigenous music influence. So her nephew, Justin Harrington, also known as Demeanor, is a hip-hop artist out of Greensboro. She wanted to see what it would be like if Justin and I got together in the studio and wrote some songs together. And with his hip-hop, my indigenous drumming and chanting, and her folk banjo and violin. And so we went down to Lafayette, Louisiana, this past August, and recorded in the studio with engineer and producer Dirk Powell. And we're hoping to release that music later on this year.
How do you balance traditional music and instruments like the hand drum that you brought in and played with Brown Skin and hip hop and more contemporary threads. How does that fuse together in your mind and preserve the kind of artistic traditions that you want to preserve?
Well, for one thing, when I think of hip-hop, I think of the beat and the groove. And for Native peoples, the drum represents the heartbeat of Mother Earth. It's one of the most primitive instruments. And so that's how we merge the two together. So I bring in that Native beat with the hip-hop, you know, the hip-hop beat and cadence, and it just works naturally.
You have another project that you're planning to release soon called Lay Down Your Guns, or another song. Do you want to set that up for us a little bit, and then we can have you play?
Sure. Lay Down Your Guns. You know, these days we hear a lot of talk about our Second Amendment rights, and I'm not going to say I want to take away people's guns, because you mentioned, you know, people, a lot of people may use them or need them for self-defense, but you mentioned like the KKK back in the day in the 50s, and our people, the Lumbee people, fought off the KKK with guns. I don't know how, you know, they tell us that people didn't get shot during that altercation, but guns were present. And I feel like if our people hadn't had those guns, what would the outcome have been if the KKK had come to Robeson County? And so I do know that people need guns to protect themselves, and history tells us so, or shows us that. But what I'm saying is that if you ever find yourself in the position to where you are the, or you could be the assailant in hurting someone, that you would take a split second or a few seconds to stop and think and choose good over evil. Because in that instance, when someone is about to end someone's life or attempt to harm someone with an act of violence, there is a spirit, or there are spirits of good and evil present. So it's just a message to encourage you to choose the good over the evil and lay down your guns.
Will you play that song for us?
Sure. If we choose good, and if we choose grace, and then surely, oh surely, evil would have no place, no place in our schools, no place in our pews. Let's pray that someday the front page will speak the truth. The truth. Lay down your guns, 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 lay down your guns.
Charlie Lowry with Lay Down Your Guns, singing it a cappella.
That was just a snippet.
Just a snippet.
I gotta make y'all wait for
just
the...
a snippet. Wait for the full release.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have much time left, but I would love to end. I mean, you've so many of your songs touch on issues that are kind of at the core of what is happening right now in Robeson County and all around the country. And I wonder for you moving forward, as you navigate kind of your own personal health journey with kind of your journey to tell the story of where you come from through music, what are your hopes for those two threads moving forward?
Well, I can only say that this is going to make me, or this has made me stronger. Even preparing for this interview and trying to get my thoughts together and realizing how much crap our people go through in Robeson County, it makes me want to stand up even stronger for our people and advocate for some of these issues that we're facing. And so I plan to, you know, write more songs. I recently accepted a nomination to sit on the board for NC Warn, an environmental organization here in North Carolina. So I'm going to, you know, devote some time to just fighting the good fight for Mother Earth and for our people and for our health and well-being.
Wonderful. Well, Charlie Lowry is a Lumbee, Tuscarora singer-songwriter. Charlie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can see her perform in Raleigh at the Poorhouse Music Hall this Saturday at 3. She'll be at Greensboro's LaBauer Park on Sunday, March 21st in the afternoon. And then take a trip down to Robeson County in April because she'll be in Lumberton on the 25th. You can find more about all of those events as well as information about her kidney donation at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, and Katie Barron. Jenny Lawson is our technical director, and Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.